What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring. Chris, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I'm excited for today's show. We have a lot to cover because the playoffs have just been absolutely incredible so far. But first, I wanted to quickly talk about the altercations that have materialized over the past 24 hours between fans and players. You know, you had Russell Westbrook getting popcorn dumped on him in Philadelphia, and you had a fan at Madison Square Garden last night spit on Trae Young. Both fans have been barred from those two arenas indefinitely by the Sixers and the Knicks. We also had Kyrie Irving say yesterday, unprompted in a Zoom presser, that he was weary of racist comments being made when the Nets play in Boston on Friday night, which is a different category than those first two incidents, I think, but, you know, somewhat tangentially related. I told you before we recorded that I don't have fully formed thoughts on this, but I feel like it's good to broach. And, you know, beyond having fans in arenas is a really good thing, and it's been really exciting. People just got to act better. But for you, just Chris, how have you kind of taken it all in with these kind of like ridiculous events marring beautiful basketball?
No, I think it's a relevant conversation. I just think our country, and not even just our country, because this is a problem in other countries as well. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for some people to just enjoy stuff in moderation without crossing over a boundary. And, there have always been problems with this sort of thing. When I was tweeting about this yesterday, I tweeted about how inappropriate it was and shitty it was, quite frankly, you know, excuse my language, that, watching the thing with Westbrook happen, and I had a fan jump in my mentions like, "Oh, come on, it's popcorn." And I was like, "What?
Okay. How are we still doing this?"
Yeah. And he was like, and he went on to say, he was like, "Man, I wish someone would come into my workplace and like dump popcorn on me. I love popcorn." I'm like, "What?" And it's just, you know, so granted, it's one weird person with a weird opinion. But, you know, keep in mind, this is with Russ, at least, first of all, he's walking off injured to the locker room injured. This is the same arena where a couple of years ago in a nationally televised game, a courtside fan flipped him off and was swearing at him no more than 10 to 12 feet from Russ. This is not that far removed from a couple weeks ago, or I guess a couple months ago with LeBron in Atlanta, I want to say, where, a fan was yelling at him and saying all these things about all these inappropriate things LeBron had said to them. And then it was kind of confirmed that LeBron hadn't actually done that. So, look, you could tie this as closely with the ugly sort of underbelly of ugliness, racist stuff that we've seen in this country for a long time. And you could get as deep and far in the weeds as you want to. I don't even think it's really that necessary. But when you talk about people just kind of lying about what players have done or what players have said, if you're talking about the stuff in Utah a few years ago and how someone said, "I didn't say anything inappropriate," and then all these other people are openly disagreeing with that. And the fact that these players deal with a lot of this stuff anyway, when they get particularly riled up, when Westbrook got really hot under the collar a couple of years ago, it might've been that Utah incident or something else. You see the stuff they're dealing with, getting flipped off, getting called out of their name, getting stuff said about their families. When they get really angry, it probably tells you that what's been said to them has been beyond the pale. Marcus Smart dealt with it before he even got to the pros and plays in Boston and has complained about some of the stuff there. So I just think it's, people talk about the players being soft and everything else and the players being entitled, you know, that you used to be able to say this or do this and it didn't bother players. They just dealt with it. Okay. We're not in the 90s or the 70s anymore. The fans, there are a lot of fans that are just frankly really entitled. We have come off a year where we weren't able to do any of these things, to go to these games. And it is amazing to see all the fan support and see how loud these fans can get. But I worry a little bit that there are too many people that maybe are just so excited to be back out that they're doing this. But there was a lot of this stuff before the pandemic too. And I cannot get over the Trae Young thing with regards to, like, we're in a pandemic and someone is spitting on this guy. It's unreal. I don't even really know what point I'm making with it, but there's a thin line with all this stuff, from how closely tied it is to some of the stuff I was talking about before, to, I don't know. It's just a very, very bad look. Yes, they're isolated fans, but on some level, everybody could probably be doing more, saying more when they see stuff like that. If they see stuff like that, it's just ugly. It's not ruining the game, but it makes me incredibly uncomfortable when we talk about how long we're still talking about Malice at the Palace and everything else, and how the players cross some line. And it's like a whole lot of fans are crossing a whole lot of lines here, and the players should not have to be in a situation where they have to show this much restraint this frequently. And I don't really know what to say more than that.
Yeah, the Trae Young stuff is straight up just disturbing. I mean, it's made me a little bit uncomfortable in general, some of the chants that were ringing out. And I know that's part of sports, and maybe I'm just like not used
No,
to.
it's made me a little bit uncomfortable too, but
Yeah.
that's what I'm saying, is like, it's hard to be full-throated about endorsing that, because again, the closer you walk up to that line, and I know it's just a word, I know it's just a phrase, it's just a chant, but when you have people going nuts to begin with to that extent, you have people that then cross a line, and it emboldens everybody else to kind of be crazier. And it just, look, I get that fans are just having a good time. Trae Young has handled it well, I think. I think it's healthy to have sort of the villain and the fan base that hates the villain. But there's a whole lot of stuff that, like, we didn't even get into this, but just the country is a little bit charged up for all sorts of reasons over the last couple of years. And you really hope that that stuff doesn't spill into this. And that's without knowing anything about which fans are doing this and saying this and what their beliefs are and what have you. But like I said, there's a whole lot of entitlement out there right now. And you just hope that as there's a whole lot of all this stuff going around, that it doesn't bubble over into something that you can't take back or get back. And like you said, spitting on someone in the midst of a pandemic, or trying to, and the idea that you're spitting on them with everybody else around you, and like, even if you didn't hit him, the other people you could hit, it's just disgusting. And I think all of this stuff is disgusting. It doesn't have to be spilling beer, throwing beer on someone. Popcorn's inappropriate too. I mean, it should, all of it should go without saying. And it's not many people, but it's enough to where it's disturbing, and it's really frustrating.
Yeah, before we move on, I just want to quote Trey Kirby from the No Dunks pod, who I think tweeted something along the lines of just boo. Booing is fun. And I agree with that sentiment. Booing is fun. If you don't like someone on the other team, boo. That's all you got to do. It's not complicated. Having fans in the stands has been just awesome to watch. From my couch still, but still very awesome to watch. I can't wait to get to an arena and watch a game in person. Those environments I really miss. Hopefully this stuff doesn't happen again throughout, well, forever, but at least throughout the rest of this postseason. All right, Chris. So, I want to start, and now that we're going to shift to basketball, I want to start with a series that I can't stop thinking about. And I wrote about it earlier this week. It's Clippers Mavs. I'm just being 100% honest. I did not see any of this coming. The Clippers were my pick to win it all this season, and now they're obviously down 0-2, dropping two straight at home, with by far the worst defense in the entire playoffs. So Chris, like I want you to put yourself in Ty Lue's shoes right now. Heading into game three, like what adjustments need to be made, if any, to avoid, that dreaded 3-0 deficit and just an almost guaranteed early exit if you're the Clippers? Just what would you do if you were Ty Lue right now?
Saying more prayers than he and the rest of the team have probably been saying. So, I mean, I was looking at it, and I don't know that I have a completely honest answer. You can always write off the first game as jitters, as, like a lack of preparedness, whatever. The second game, looking from the very first possession to possessions, I mean, they're throwing Paul George at him. After the first two or three possessions, they're throwing Kawhi Leonard at Luka. They're trapping, I wouldn't say hard, but they're kind of showing really hard on him, to kind of force the ball out of his hands at times. They're doing the thing where they kind of shade just enough to let him into the paint a little bit, but then trail him really aggressively to make sure that he's kind of trapped from behind and in front. And the truth is, like, none of it is working. If and when he's passing to somebody else, everybody's hitting their shots. What are they shooting? 53% for the series from 3?
970%, actually.
Right. So I don't know what the answer is. I mean, my inclination would be to trap him more aggressively, Luka, and really just force the guys to prove they can keep hitting shots. But that's kind of a bold strategy when they've already hit better than 50% of their shots. You could try to drop really far down and make Luka beat you as a shooter, but he's hitting his shots too, and some of them have been like 32-foot bombs. And a couple of them have been like consecutive possessions in a row. I don't know what you do in a situation like this. I mean, really, if I'm being honest at this point, the real answer feels like they don't really have any, which is a crazy thing to say, but like they have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George on their roster, and they don't have a single person on that group who's like well equipped to guard Luka, which
Which
that
means there's no one in the world that can guard
probably
Luka.
not. Probably not. And I mean, like, the truth is, if Dallas is going to hit anywhere near 50% of their shots and you're forcing the ball out of Luka's hands when he's hitting other people, they're scoring too. I think they've scored on the seven possessions they've trapped on in pick and rolls. I think they've gotten like 8 points out of that. So they're not inefficient with that at all. I mean, they're doing pretty well with that as well. I don't know if there's a really great answer. And, like I said, the strategy I guess I would probably go with is to go after him hard. Because what annoys me, number one, is that last year when they played, they had the same matchup, and it looks a whole lot like last year where they just didn't have many answers for him. Secondly, what annoys me is that he's scoring too well and too easily sometimes, where he does get in the paint and he's just blowing past Zubac at times, to get to the basket for a layup or a dunk in, or one or two cases. And it's just kind of like, okay, you definitely can't do that. But, like I said, I guess you just have to gamble a little bit. If it means occasionally just giving him a lot of space and daring him to shoot, which, it's a hard pill to swallow when he's making some of those, or you're just daring his teammates, Finney Smith in particular, to just keep shooting as well as they're shooting. But none of these are good options. And it just kind of feels like their offense is too good for the Clippers defense, which is a scary thing to say. And if the Clippers can't quite keep up scoring, which, the stat is out there, Dallas was what, the number three defense in the league against top 10 offenses. It might just kind of be lights out, but it doesn't look like Ty Lue has that much to go to, or that he's really reluctant to go to it if he's got tricks up his sleeve. I'm a little bit surprised that it looks so much like last year's series. I figured it would look different. But then again, Brunson is back. Porzingis is out there. Two guys that weren't there the whole time last postseason. But my goodness, Dallas looks scary. And it's really exciting to think about what that next series would look like if they advance against the Jazz. It would be a great matchup.
Yeah, so I mentioned that I wrote about this series after game one, and blitzing is what I advocated for. I thought that the Clippers did a really good job of being super aggressive at the point of attack with whoever was setting the screen for Luka in the fourth quarter of game one. I mean, Luka had 1 point, I think, in that
You're right.
quarter, which is
Yep.
pretty, that's good if you're the Clippers. That's what you want. So they started game two one of the first ball screens, Zubats comes up and tries to squeeze the ball out of Luka's hands, tries to blitz him. And Luka just like turns the corner and gets all the way into the paint for a dunk. And
that's
yeah. And I think Ty Lue at that point was like, all right, we are just, we're not doing that. So like, I don't know. I mean, they're switching a ton. If I'm Ty Lue, honestly, I don't know if I'm benching Patrick Beverley for the rest of the series, but I'm not playing him as often as I probably expected to heading in. And it stinks because Zubats is really good, but he just, you know, he's moving his feet. He's trying his hardest. I don't think I would be cutting his minutes too, I think, if I was Ty Lue. I mean, when I watch Luka, like with Pat Beverley on him, it just reminds me of like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids outtakes. Like, it's just extremely difficult to watch.
Oh, buddy.
So, like, if I was Ty Lue, I would try to play Terrence Mann way more. I thought he was going to be a fixture in the rotation based on how exciting he's been throughout the regular season and just, like, the energy he provides. And they started to play him. I think he played the whole fourth quarter of Game 2, which was really good to see. But, like, you know, like, Luke Kennard just hasn't played at all. You know, I would probably play Reggie Jackson a little bit more, and I would stay small as much as possible with Morris at the five, but, you know, have larger bodies at those guard positions so I can switch and just not get absolutely obliterated by Luka. Like, I don't know, man. Like, I think that the Serge Ibaka injury is really, really critical, and not enough people are talking about it. The fact that this guy has played like 40 total minutes in the past 2 months and plays like 6 minutes in game two and just was not, it just wasn't working out for him. So I don't know what you do beyond some of those rotational changes, but then I look at like the 3-point shooting, as you mentioned, and it's like, at some point it's got to come back to earth, right? Like, the Clippers were the best 3-point shooting team in the NBA this season.
Yep.
They're not hitting shots right now. They're shooting 32% from deep. The Mavs are at 53%, as you said, 57% on pull-ups, which is just like, that can't be sustainable. And, you know, if it is, then you're just going to lose. I'm sorry. That's just the NBA today, with the volume of 3-point shots that are going in. But like, I don't know what else there is to do if you're Ty Lue besides cross your fingers, say a prayer, as you mentioned. Like, they've been doing everything they can to stop Luka, and it just hasn't been enough.
Yeah, I mean, so to get into some of what you said, the Beverley possessions where he's trying to guard Luka, and I think one of the things that bothers me too, but it all comes back to how well Dallas is shooting from three. Everybody's kind of on this island because you're afraid to leave the shooters. So Luka, you know, basically backs in Beverly or whoever else from the 3-point line all the way down and, you know, to the block, and then scores. And it looks so helpless. I was trying to think of what it makes me think about. And I just keep thinking about these Michael Jackson videos where like, or even like I YouTube searched the Michael Jackson video game Moonwalker, where there's just like an array of dudes, bad guys, that come in and are trying to beat you up, and one by one you just kind of take them apart. And that's kind of what it feels like, as Luka just mows down all these Clippers defenders. Like, it's insane. But
that's the greatest metaphor or similar
or worse.
You want to say
or worse.
No, it's the best. No, give yourself a pat on the back there.
One or the other. But it does kind of just have that feel though of, you know, the Clippers are, they're either going all the way in where you said they're blitzing, you know, they're trapping and not doing it very efficiently, or they're basically switching and they're saying, okay, you're by yourself here, you're on an island, and they're doing it with Beverly. And even when they're doing it with Kawhi or other people, it's not. Luka's just too big and too tall, and he can score over anybody. If you throw too many people at him, he can pass to the right guy, and you've got to hope at a certain point that they come back down to earth. But even if they hit 35 or 40%, that's still enough to potentially beat you with how efficiently they operate. So I don't know. I mean, they could very easily get through a 4-game series and just sweep this thing. while shooting 50, 45% for the series. I mean, so that's where I'm at a certain point, the Clippers just have to hope. I don't really think within the rotational stuff that you talked about, none of it really feels like it's such a difference maker to where it turns the whole series, unless PG and gets hot, you know, and really some of the guys that you expect to be doing better. You know, quite frankly, I don't know if I had the Clippers pegged as the favorite in the West, but you know, the reason that I had them winning the series in seven, which I guess technically still could happen, is that, you know, they, like you said, they were the best 3-point shooting team in the league. Between Jackson and Morris, I think they might have been literally 1 and 2 for either the second half of the season or most of the season in terms of 3-point shooting. And they're both really struggling in this series as far as shooting the ball. So, I mean, I won't say it's everything that could go wrong is going wrong, but it's a lot of the stuff that they would need to go right isn't going right. And you know, the defense, it's not necessarily awful defense, but their defense doesn't look nearly as good as Dallas's offense, and that's just not going to get it done here.
Yeah, I mean, there's some possessions where Kawhi is fighting through screens and he's refusing to switch. And I mean, that obviously takes a ton of energy. Meanwhile, you know, he leads the Clippers in usage, obviously. He's their go-to scorer. And I mean, he's getting buckets in his own right. And maybe is even, we're talking about him a little bit less than we should, given how well he played. In game two, I thought that first half where he dropped 30, I want to say like an efficient 30, it was just like one of the better halves of basketball I've seen that I can even remember. It was absolutely incredible. You know, I might be getting ahead of myself, which is something that I tend to do when, you know, a team is down 0-2 like this and is playing, they're playing well, but just the other team just seems like they have their number. Like, what do you think, Chris, is the fallout for the Clippers if they were to actually lose this series? Like, and specifically, you know, I just mentioned Kawhi. We never talked about, throughout this entire season, his free agency. It was just like a non-story. I feel like it was a bit of a fait accompli that he would re-sign with the Clippers as soon as he was able to do so on a long-term max. Like, is he a legitimate flight risk now if you lose in the first round? Just like, what are even the basketball reasons for him to stay? I can't think of any.
Man, we just watched Kawhi win a championship and say peace. So, I mean, when you lose in the first round, you know, after barely, well, I won't say barely, I guess they won in six last year, right, against Dallas. But, you know, it was an uncomfortably tight series last year as well.
Without Porzingis, yeah.
Without Porzingis, then losing, you know, in a really kind of heartbreaking sort of way, and, you know, giving up a 3-1 lead, which you could slice that a couple different ways last year. On the one hand, you could say, man, that was kind of fluky that happened. We're going to come back better next year because of it. And yeah, that would not have been the case here. I mean, they looked really solid both years coming into the playoffs as far as how well they were shooting, as far as Paul George just being, you know, firing on all cylinders. This would be pretty disheartening. And like you said, I was kind of thinking in my own head, like, what would be the motive to stay? At that point, the basketball reasons to stay, obviously, is from California. And you look at their roster, man, and obviously you mentioned Kennard, and there's a number of other guys on this roster, man, that aren't going anywhere unless they're traded, I guess. But, you know, what you would get for Kennard or anything else at this point, there's a lot of guys that are locked in for a while here in LA. And so this is kind of your roster. You know, all along, people were kind of curious, would they go get a point guard? You know, who could they get? Who realistically could they get because of their payroll being so high already? I don't really know what the motivation to stay is, other than if he just really wants to get it done there. But it's disheartening to look at the situation and realize, man, this looks so much like the series last year, except they're beating us now. And we're defending it kind of the same way we did. There's a new coach, I guess, but it looks a lot like last year, except Dallas looks better and they're healthier than they were last year. So I don't really know what the answer is, but yeah, I think he absolutely has to be viewed as a flight risk. You've got a big market team that, you know, looks on the upswing. Certainly, you know, I don't know how big a concern, you know, New York is specifically, but there are certainly places to go if Kawhi wants to do that. But, you know, who knows exactly what's in his head? Like I said, he won it before and still decided to leave. So I don't know. But it's very clear that the makeup of him and PG is kind of the two key guys is not enough unless you're suggesting that they've just gotten bad matchups. And I mean, at this point, you know, they will have played two contenders in the West between Denver and Dallas. Dallas isn't going anywhere. And you could make the argument that they're not even a top four team in the West necessarily, you know, depending on the way stuff shook out this year, depending on what you think of Phoenix going forward, the Lakers are there. So I don't know that the Clippers are so great or that they've shown that they're so great that Kawhi should have reason to just say, I'm staying no matter what. So that's got to be a huge concern just from the standpoint of it's not clear how much flexibility the Clippers have to really improve quickly.
I mean, you look at the roster, as you said, a lot of guys on long-term deals. Marcus Morris is getting paid. Luke Kennard's getting paid. I mean, they don't have any draft picks really because or tradable draft picks because of the trade that brought in Paul George. They don't have any cap space. The one guy who I look at that you could move in, this is probably more closely aligned with like fantasy basketball, but move Paul George for another star. And I, you know, I tried to think of any possibilities out there that would seem even semi-realistic. And it's just, you throw some of the names like Brad Beal or Dame up in Portland. Like, I don't know. I can't actually see a trade like that materializing. It's just those star for star trades are so, so rare for a reason. The one team that also I want to just mention that I'm not a capologist. I briefly looked at this, and I think it's technically possible. I know Bam Adebayo just signed that extension, but if Miami, if Kawhi Leonard takes a meeting with Pat Riley, if I were the Clippers, I would just—I don't know—I would just melt into a puddle because that situation is just absolutely perfect for him. Jimmy, Bam, that's just a big three. You're in the Eastern Conference, an easier path to the title. I don't know how realistic any of that is. I'm just kind of throwing it out there. But yeah, man, it's looking really interesting for the Clippers. I don't think that the series is over yet because I have so much respect for Kawhi above everything. But down 0-2, it's tough. So like speaking of just like disappointments, for you, Chris, like what player has been, would you say has been the most disappointing in the entire postseason so far?
I would probably say Randall from the Knicks so far. Just, you know, and I get that he's kind of in that weird gray area where absolutely he's had a star season. Do we put him on that same level? I mean, theoretically, I guess you could maybe float Paul George in that conversation, but we've kind of seen this from him before. So it feels a little, I mean, we could do that, but it almost feels redundant to say that. And obviously, if he and Kawhi were both playing at, you know, just superstar levels, then we're not having the whole opening segment be about the Clippers to begin with. But Randall, you know, you and I have gone back and forth kind of about what we expected with the Hawks-Knicks series, and you know, I think you might, you know, have been the most bullish on the Hawks to begin with regards to saying that you thought they could win in five. And I was like, oh, you're crazy, essentially. Like, that series will go at least six or seven. And, you know, I don't know if all that for you was, like, rooted in believing in the Knicks, not believing in the Knicks offense or not believing in Randall. But, yeah, I mean, Randall hasn't really, I mean, there were times last night where he looked like he didn't want to shoot, where he actually had looks and just wasn't shooting them or wasn't really making aggressive moves to the basket. And look, the Hawks are really talented. I think they're underrated defensively. Even I think I underrated them even defensively when they weren't at full strength and at full health. But I don't think their defense is so great to wear. Like, I think they have a good scheme on Randall, but I don't think it's such a suffocating system that they're running against him to where he can't do anything. So I've been, you know, and quite frankly, like, you could make the argument that they're up 2-0. And obviously you could go back and forth with that. You know, if Nate McMillan doesn't sit his bench forever, in game two that, you know, that the series is 2-0 in favor of the Hawks. So you could do that, you know, if sort of thing all day long. But Randall has not really looked himself. And, you know, we talked all year about how much he was overshooting his expectations as far as, you know, expected field goal percentage, you know, based on how closely guys are guarding him and how he shot in the past and what an average player would be expected to shoot on the same looks and the same openness. And he's, you know, overshot those metrics all year long. But if this is just a regression to the mean, what a bad time for it. You know, the Knicks did just enough to kind of squeak that win out yesterday, but it wasn't really that much because of him at all. If anything, you know, I'm sure Knicks fans are thanking God that Thibodeau, you know, came to his senses and took Peyton out and just started Rose and went with them in the second half and rode Derrick Rose. But, you know, it's hard to imagine the Knicks winning that series without Randall playing better. And so he's probably been the most disappointing frontline guy that I've looked at so far.
Yeah, I really like the defensive coverages that Atlanta's thrown at him. I mean, John Collins gets in the early foul trouble, and then you got to play Gallo. And eventually in the third quarter, Randall finally started to get really aggressive and attack Gallo before they could kind of load up to stop him. But like, yeah, you know, you said something interesting that Randall didn't really look like himself over the past couple of games. And that's been my feeling about him the entire season. I'm just like, this guy doesn't look like Julius Randle to me. And literally every single time to this day, I know I sound like such a hater, but whenever he makes a three, I'm surprised. Like, there are a lot of players around the league, whenever they miss a three, I just expect every shot to go in. With Randle, I expect every single three not to go in. I expect every pull-up two, which he's not accurate or efficient on the pull-up twos still. I expect those to all not go in, and they haven't for the most part. So that's a really interesting one. You know, this is a little random, but, you know, RJ Barrett not playing in the fourth quarter at all is also, you know, if I was a Knicks fan, I'd be like, man, this is a lot of stuff happened in that game too for them to come back. And I think a lot of it, you know, you wrote about it really well on the site, but a lot of it was just Atlanta shooting itself in the foot. I felt like there was some just rotational decisions and substitution decisions that Nate McMillan made that were just way too conservative.
I love Nate McMillan, but it's just, if you could take regular season Nate McMillan and just like, he's the guy I think about when I'm, you know, when people talk about how stuck in the mud NFL coaches are about punting, you know, whenever they get to fourth down, no matter, you know, it could be fourth and like a centimeter and you're punting no matter what. And Nate McMillan does that with his, obviously it was in the story too, but I found myself looking at my watch, you know, with how regards, I don't even have a watch, but like I was still looking at my non-existent watch, trying to figure out when the hell he was going to bring Trae Young back in the game. Or if not Trae, and I said this on Twitter, like, you've got Bogdanovich, who I get that he's been with your starters for, you know, most of the year and that you've been using him that way. But the guy was a sixth man in Sacramento for years. Like, I mean, he was a great, maybe not great, but he was a very good creator with like bench rotations, a guy that can get his own basket, but also is fantastic to play with your top guys because he can just serve as a spot up shooter as well. And I mean, has been killing the Knicks throughout the series with, you know, random shots that he comes up with or loose balls that he comes up with. So I just find myself at a loss where I guess your bench was really effective last game, and Lou Williams was so hot in game one to where I actually was almost wondering, like, do you bring Trae back? Is it worth bringing Trae back right now? Since you theoretically don't want to put two really poor defenders out there at the same time, undersized poor defenders out there at the same time in Trae and Lou. But, you know, like, Lou's got it going. Maybe you just give Trae an extra breather here if you don't really need him. And obviously it was the right decision to bring Trae back in. So it's not to say Nate never makes the right calls, but man, he makes such conservative calls and obviously kind of invokes some of the Indiana stuff. And it was funny because I, you know, the story got retweeted a decent amount of times for something that I didn't think anybody would care about. Knicks fans were too happy to care about retweeting a story like that. Hawks fans are too dejected to retweet a story like that. But then I look up, I'm like, oh, this story's getting a decent amount of traction. I look up and it's all Pacers fans retweeting the hell out of the story because they're like, been there, done that. I know all about this. This is exactly what I was thinking as I was watching the game. And it's fascinating because, you know, I could sing Nate McMillan's praises all day long about how well and how much his teams have overachieved in the regular season, I think largely because of how good he is. But the playoffs, everything is just so important in the playoffs. And, you know, even Thibodeau realizing that I can't start Elfrid Payton here in the second half. It's going to make for a fascinating finish just because of what you said about Barrett and Randall and Rose, who admitted to being pretty tired yesterday. And, you know, we all have the concerns about his body, yeah. As great as he's been. I mean, he's been fantastic this series, this season for them, but it's, you know, they did get it going a little bit with Bullock and Obi Toppin made great contributions. Now I'm getting off subject, but it was that series. I was most excited about that series to begin with, and it's living up to the hype.
One of the more interesting, I mean, the analogy that you used with NFL coaches, you know, what comes to mind when I think of Nate McMillan is how NFL coaches, I don't even know if they still do this because I basically stopped watching football a few years ago.
Me too.
Like having scripted plays, like the first 15 plays of the game, like we know what we're doing before the game starts. I always thought that was the height of stupidity. And when you look at Nate McMillan, like Trey and Bogdan played the exact same amount of minutes. They subbed in and out of the game at the exact same time throughout the entire game. And it just has that scripted feel to me where it's like he headed into the game and this is when I'm subbing Trey and Bogdan in. This is when I'm subbing them out. This is how much they're going to play together. This is what this stint's going to look like, regardless of what is happening in front of his eyes. Maybe that's unfair, but that's just kind of how it transpired from my perspective and my vantage point. I'm like in my notes, I'm writing, why is Trey and Bogdan not on the floor? Like, what is happening? You know, you can stagger those two. You can play one with a bench. Like, that's probably a good idea to do that.
Held them out for almost eight. They had that stretch where they only made one basket over 13 possessions. They missed so 12 brutal. Out of 13. And I looked back at how long a stretch that was. I think Trey and Bogdan were on the court together for like the first two possessions of it. But after that, it was 7:39 of game time, 7 minutes, 39 seconds that those guys were out. And 8 minutes for a playoff game is a long time to hold out. Really your two best scorers and to do it together.
Yeah. And you can't score.
You're not scoring anything. You're watching Gallinari just play horribly. It was pretty brutal. And, you know, the Knicks had Randall and Rose and, you know, at one point Noel, like they had essentially, I know Rose wasn't a starter for them, but they essentially had three starters on the court for a chunk of that time. And yeah, it just kind of mind blowing to watch that happen. And it's interesting. You know, Thibodeau was probably reluctant to start Rose in the second half, obviously did it, but you know, it's crazy. Even for Thibodeau, who already puts his pedal to the metal with regards to his minutes and, you know, his players' minutes and stuff like that, that he's going to go the extra step even with Rose and the, you know, the concerns we've had about Rose for years with his body holding up and everything else. And just whether or not you have enough off the bench at that point, if you start him in the second half, and the fact that even he extended him and played him 39 minutes. And then we're looking at 22-year-old Trae Young not doing that. It just has the feel of like the Milwaukee stuff from the last couple of years where Giannis would play 34 minutes and Bud would kind of, you know, well, I don't know if I want to push Giannis. He's not used to playing more than 35. And it's like, come on, man. Like, what are we doing here? When Rose can play 39 and you're not playing your 22-year-old more than 36, like, what are we doing here? What's the point here? So it'll be curious to see what happens. I would venture to guess that – I would hope to guess – that Nate will, you know, loosen the reins a little bit and just let his guys play. Because they were up by a pretty comfortable margin. They were up by, what, 11, 12? I think they started the second half up 13. And that evaporated really quickly, and that pretty much coincided with when Nate pulled his starters. And, you know, again, not just pulling them, but, like, pulling them essentially en masse, 3, 4, 5 at a time. And, you know, when you're doing the line change sort of thing the way you do in hockey – it opens you up quite a bit to just having the wheels fall off when you don't put those guys back in.
Yeah, no more Okongwu also. I just want to, you know, no disrespect love him, to him. He's going to be awesome, but just John Collins needs to be your backup five. This is the playoffs. Like, what are we even doing? I still think Atlanta is going to win in five because I'm not a coward, and that was my pre-series prediction. As soon as I'm wrong, you can yell at me, and everyone, all of our wonderful listeners can send in angry emails. Real quick, I just want to say that my most disappointing player is Bam Adebayo. And this pains me because I love Bam, one of my favorite players in the league. Just, you know, I wrote a piece earlier this season about how I thought he was one of the more underappreciated defenders and probably should have been a top three pick for defensive player of the year. Defensively, he's been okay, I think, in this series against the Bucks so far. I'm not going to blame him for Bryn Forbes hitting 19 three-pointers in the first half of game two. But his tentativeness on offense is just, you can't, like, what happened? Like, he spent the entire regular season, the offseason, developing this mid-range pull-up that's pretty good, pretty dangerous and threatening. And then he just has couched it, basically, for the entire series so far. I mean, he refuses to attack Brook Lopez when Brook is, you know, deep dropping. And, you know, there was this one play where Jimmy Butler just literally looks at Bam as Bam looks at him. Bam catches a pass at the right elbow, looks at Jimmy, and Jimmy waves his arm to, like, attack. It's like, just go at him, man. Like, you're a foul magnet. You're extremely capable of finishing around the basket. Just, like, he's got to be more aggressive. So that's been super disappointing, honestly. And, I mean, Jimmy has also played terribly, but I'm not going to say any bad things about Jimmy Butler ever for the rest of my life.
Bam's a good pick. Bam's a good pick. I mean, it has been... I mean, you've got Brook dropping into the stands, basically, you know, underneath the basket. And that always is tough. And I feel like some of the same stuff I said with Randall is applicable here, probably even more so with Bam, like you said. You can just see the wheels turning in his head of to shoot or not to shoot, you know, and that always – It becomes psychological at that point. And it is one of those things where if you're Pat Riley or you're Spo, you just want him to shoot. You just want him to make a quick decision. The more indecisiveness you've got, the more the defense is going to dare you to keep doing that. And I mean, obviously this is an offense where when you think about the things they do best, whether it's Jimmy going to the hole, whether it's Duncan Robinson coming off a screen, you know, everything they do more or less is kind of done better when it's done quickly, as opposed to kind of being tentative. It's not an offense where you want guys to just sit and kind of take their time and go one-on-one. It's never quite been an offense like that. So that's a really good pick because he hasn't looked himself either. It's funny, like Randall, this is his first go round as a star and an all-star with Bam. He's still so young that I could be a little bit more forgiving of him just because I think most young stars kind of have that rough postseason at least once, at least in one instance where they're kind of a focal point. They don't know how to handle or react to it. Sometimes when they're in new settings, we saw it with LeBron, obviously against the Mavericks years and years ago. But yeah, it's been rough, and you know, who knows how much more pressure is added when the Bucks are hitting all those shots they did in the last game, but yeah, Bam, it doesn't look like the same player in the same way that we were saying about Randall, where it just doesn't look like the same guy. But who knows? You know, Bam, for how consistent he was the whole season and, you know, kind of the push to become a true star the last couple of years, you could make the argument that he'd looked consistent and consistently like a star for longer than Randall had. So that's a good pick on your part.
Bam, where was the hesitancy last year in the Eastern Conference Finals against the Celtics? That's all I want to know. I mean, like, if you're gonna be this way, just you should have done that against Daniel Tice instead of mowing him over on every single possession. Miami has the worst offense in the playoffs so far. We have an email from Ethan about a team that has no problem getting buckets. Ethan writes, I was watching highlights of Nets vs. Celtics game two, and I noticed KD at center circle jumping for the tip-off against Tristan Thompson, and it made me think, I remember you mentioning earlier in the season that you were concerned with Steve Nash's lack of coaching experience going into the season. I had the same concerns. With their position at the top of the Eastern Conference and the talent on their roster, I was curious if you or any of your co-hosts, that would be you, Chris, had any of the same issues going into the playoffs. Would love to hear what you think. I can't wait to hear your new episodes when they come out. Keep it up. Thank you so much, Ethan, for that email. I think we're going to synthesize this email just with a simple question. Chris, how do we know if Steve Nash is a good coach or a bad coach?
This is normally the time of year you start to get some of those answers. Well, I don't want to boil it down to just that, because even what I was saying about Nate McMillan, I think Nate McMillan does really well in the regular season, and this is kind of where you have a lot of his attributes tested. Almost like your NBA 2K sliders, but for coaches instead of players, where, mm-hmm. you know, how aggressive are you going to be? How conservative are you going to be when your guy gets a second foul? And, you know, I don't want to slander Steve Nash. I don't think this will be slander. I don't know that we'll take a whole lot from this series with regards to whether or not he's doing really well or not. I mean, they should win the series.
Well, that's just you're just slandering the Celtics now. You're not slandering Steve
Nash. I mean, am I though? look, if the Celtics were even close to having made this a 1-1 series, if they come back and win the next two, or, you know, win the next one and are close in one of the next two, I don't expect much more from them than to take one game off the Nets here. So, but yeah, I mean, like it's obviously kind of a whittled down attack from what the Celtics would have at full strength. So I don't know how much you really prove about how good a coach someone is when they're doing kind of what's expected. If anything, what you could say is that they kind of snapped out of it toward the end of game one, Brooklyn. I don't know how much of that I attribute to Nash as much as just the guys getting reps together again. But I will say they have looked good. I think maybe one of the things that Nash was influential with, was kind of just more kind of his easygoing nature and kind of his ability to let guys ease into their roles. So one of the things that really stood out to me when they got Blake Griffin, for instance, who's looked incredible, you know, at times during the series and, you know, 5 years younger at sometimes in the series, was that, you know, they didn't rush Brooke into playing as soon as they signed him. That it was a couple of weeks before he played a game with the Nets after he signed with them. And, you know, the constant conversations he's having with Nash about how they're going to use him and how they're going to allow him to fit in instead of really asking much of him. And that has looked really smart so far. You ask Kyrie Irving whether Nash is a good coach or not and what he would base that on, it might be his ability to get out of the way. So it's such a subjective sort of thing. But truthfully, I don't think we'll be able to answer the question. We won't be able to answer it fully, I think, for a couple of years probably. But I really don't think we'll even have kind of the making of an answer until we get Brooklyn matched up with a team that's kind of on even footing. So whether that's a series against the Bucks or the Sixers or something like that, where they're a little bit more toe-to-toe as far as, you know, a team that can really match up with them better than Boston can. I don't think Boston is a good enough match for them to really kind of size this up and square, you know, exactly how great or how poor Nash is. I think he's fine for what we've seen so far, but I don't think they've really been tested just yet.
Yeah, I think this question is very interesting because the Nets, as you said, they haven't had to make any real adjustments at all. And there's a whole bunch of adjustments that they could make if they ever wanted to. You know, I think starting Blake at the five in this series was really fascinating for a variety of reasons. And the Celtics have tried to attack him on switches whenever they can. But just like how this Nets team plays basketball is just so interesting. I mean, they've really dialed up the ISO ball with Harden. I mean, they're hunting Evan Fournier every chance they get with either Harden or Kyrie. They're playing really fast off misses. It's just like the isolations, if you look at some of the numbers, like they're isolating more frequently than even those Rockets teams did that went to the Western Conference Finals. And D'Antoni's obviously sitting on that bench too. And I think that his imprint is felt for sure. But then you just look at, like, you know, DeAndre Jordan hasn't really played at all since, you know, he played poorly in those back-to-back losses against the Bucks, which I don't even know when those were. It was a while ago, though, like several weeks. And so for Nash to kind of put Claxton into the rotation for Jordan to start Blake, as I already said, instead of starting Jordan, I think that all that's really interesting. And sometimes, you know, you can overcomplicate things. And so when you have the overwhelming talent, the just like the unstoppable shot creation and all the space in the world, plus like role players who've really embraced what they are and what they mean to the team, like Bruce Brown and even Blake, like, I don't know that Nash needs to really do anything. And this sounds, I hope this does not sound insulting because I do not mean for it to be. That's just the situation that he's in. It's a fantastic situation. He has Harden, he has KD, and he has Kyrie. Like, those are all NBA caliber players that can do basically anything whenever they want. And I'm really fascinated to see how they react when they're actually pressed and not going up against a team that has Jabari Parker playing big minutes. That's basically my feeling on it.
Yeah.
Okay, Open Floor Globe, that is our show for today. Thank you so much for all the wonderful emails. Rohan and I will be back on Tuesday instead of Monday because I'm going to Florida for Memorial Day weekend. I'm very excited. Me and Chris, we will be back a week from today. Until then, please keep your questions coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Until then, again, everyone stay safe, enjoy the weekend, and we'll see you on the other side.